You know, there's something about the sounds and the lights and everything around us that we see during the season that says this is just a different time of year. And that song, I love that song. It kind of has a way of pulling us in. And, you know, regardless of what we believe about Christmas or what we believe about Jesus or any of those things, it has a way of pulling us into the spirit of the season. So really excited you're here this morning. My name's Kurt, if we haven't had a chance to meet. And, we want to believe the Christmas story, right? We want to believe in Santa. We get to the biblical story of Christmas, and for many of our lives, maybe even we have believed it, and though for others of us, maybe we get to certain points, and you know, the faith we had in Jesus and in who Jesus is and the way he arrived in the world, we want to believe it, but we think, well, it was good as a child, but as we begin to grow and mature and we take in new information and we get to kind of adult level things, we begin to realize that maybe sometimes the faith we had as a child doesn't stand up to the things we deal with as an adult. And so we find ourselves at times struggling to believe. And so today we're going to take a look at, you know, how Christmas brings us back and begs the question, do you believe? And so I ran across a really fascinating article. I don't know why these things are fascinating to me, but it was titled, Why We Celebrate Christmas Even Though I Don't Believe in God. Let me share a few excerpts from the article. It says, we're not religious anymore. I guess you could say we aren't Christians since we don't believe that Jesus was divine. Culturally, though, we are Christian, namely in the holidays we celebrate and the stories we've grown up with. Even though I don't practice, I still feel Catholic in a lot of ways. I still celebrate Christian holidays, including Christmas. And I would say that's probably true for many people in our culture today. We had no problem celebrating Christmas and enjoying all of its traditions without explaining that God is this all-knowing being that we should fear and respect and love above all things. And for that, I'm glad, because it was the one thing I struggled with, especially as I've grown up. I felt that even when I tried as hard as I could to be a good Catholic, I fell short in a lot of ways. In fact, in a lot of ways, I felt as though growing up to believe every miraculous and magical thing in Catholicism made growing up a hard reality. When I realized I didn't agree with all the church's teachings, I was disillusioned from the church. I believed in it all, the miracles, the saints, the guardian angels, heaven, hell, Jesus looking out for me, Mary looking out for me. I believed that if I was a good enough girl, I could get a miracle out of it. Of course, that seems childish at best and ridiculously selfish at worst, but I was a kid. And there's just something, when I was reading this, I thought, man, we believe, at least culturally we say, I believe, but like, do I really believe in the person of Christmas? Do I believe in the story of Christmas, the biblical story of Christmas? And this is one of the things Christmas does. It causes us to come back to that question, do you believe? And so perhaps some of what I'm going to talk about today has caused you to take a step back in faith or back away from faith or even caused you to step back away from trusting in who Jesus is. And so I want to share some thoughts with you today that come from one of my favorite writers, theologians, and a guy by the name of Andy Stanley. These lines of thought on belief that they just were really powerful to me because, you know, if we're honest, we all have a point of reference when it comes to faith. We all have a worldview when it comes to faith. All of us, every single one of us. You have one, I have one, we all have one. Now, you may not be able to real articulately share it or define it, or if I were to ask you, okay, what's your worldview? Say, well, here's what it is. But we all have one. And your frame of reference, the way in which you see the world, the way in which you view the world actually determines things for you. Not only things of faith, but things like right and wrong, what's just and what's unjust, what's important to you and what's not important to you. It frames for us what's fair and what's not fair. It even, you know, frames, you know, to some degree, it informs how we should behave. And not that you do behave that way, but you have certain things you're like, well, I ought to behave this way or I ought not to behave this way. And another thing that's really interesting when it comes to our frame of reference, the way we view the world, is that it's often something that we inherit. It's something that we absorbed or took in, especially from our younger years when we were children. We're not a blank slate. And so the way we view the world, the way that we interpret circumstances, the way we interpret events in life, a lot of this is something we inherit. And perhaps, you know, many of you, like me, were raised in a religious context. You were raised in a faith environment. Or maybe you were raised in like a sort of faith environment. You know what I'm saying? Like a sort of faith environment. Like we went to church, but we didn't really talk about it when we got home. Or we went to church, but there was never really a personal nature to our faith. And it was just like this general idea that there's a God. Or maybe you were raised in an academic environment where it was all about your mind. It was all about thinking. And if we can really boil it down, it's about science. It was about, you know, the world world's put together in certain ways. And then as you grow up, you begin to see there's holes with like what people of faith believe and, you know, what science can actually show. And you felt like, if I'm going to have like a faith in Jesus and that he is who he says he is and he did come into the world, then I've got to like check my brain at the door. Because there's certain things, at least, that some people in faith say that don't line up scientifically with data. Or maybe it was a moralistic framework or a legalistic framework where you were told, like, you have to behave this way and God is happy with you. And if you don't, well, you know, like, he's out to get you, right? Like, every now and then somebody will walk in the doors of, you know, the front doors out in the commons and they'll be like, oh my gosh, I made it. And like, lightning hasn't struck yet. I just kind of chuckle because that tells me something, right? It tells me something about like our worldview or the way we see God. And so to some degree, especially when it comes to faith, whoever raised you, whatever context you were raised in, actually has a lot to do with how you view God and the framework that you have. And sometimes the things that we were told aren't necessarily accurate, and sometimes they don't stand up over the test of time. And then we go off to school, right? We like become an adult, or we go off and get our first job, and we learn, man, we're way smarter than our parents were, right? And so we begin to like adapt that framework, and we begin to kind of make it ours based on what we've read and what we've learned and what that one professor said that totally caused my whole faith foundation to blow up. Or you realize, oh my gosh, my parents were a lot smarter than I thought they were, right? And so then you like go back to your original frame of reference. And so we have all these things that influence how we view the world, or perhaps, maybe for you, you got to certain places and you just abandoned it. You just, you know, you just realized what I grew up with as a child, it doesn't, you know, withstand kind of the adulting life that I'm in right now. Or maybe you just continue to grow and learn, or you discovered that much of the framework that you'd been handed, it just doesn't make sense anymore. And so, you know, we begin to have this tension between what we believe or we've believed and what we've experienced. And even what our behavior is. And you can only live in that tension for so long before we generally start gravitating toward what we've experienced. And so when you see something in the world, when you learn things about the world, when you experience things in the world that just don't line up with the way you think or you understand that they're supposed to go, I mean, it's just bothersome to us. And over time, you know, we end up beginning to say, man, maybe that stuff the church taught me when I was a kid, it wasn't really accurate. Or over time, maybe some of the stuff that you had faith in didn't stand up over time. And again, at some point in time, we kind of abandoned it. And we celebrate Christmas, you know, culturally, but do we really believe the story of Christmas? So as we move toward Christmas, I mean, we're what now? Kids, how many days away are we? Like 8 or 9, something like that? You know, as we move toward Christmas, the birth of Christ, this most moment where we celebrate the birth of Christ, I want to invite you to invite or re-invite Jesus, all right, the original story of Christmas, back into the center of your worldview. I mean, that's really what I want us to see today, because Christmas has a way of helping us do that. And I know what some of you are thinking. Some of you are you're going, okay, Kurt, well, I'm here, and you know, you're like, the price of admission on that for me. I mean, I used to believe, but again, I've got data and I've got experiences, and it's like I got to check my brain at the door to really believe in the things of faith. It's almost like having a faith in faith. And so, you know, it worked fine for me as a kid, but I just don't know if I can fully lean back into that. I get that. I mean, that's reasonable. But here's some good news. Here's something we're going to look at here in a bit. And you may have never considered this, but the first Christians, all right, the original version of Christianity, it didn't require anyone to sacrifice what they'd experienced or what they knew. All right, think about that for a minute. It didn't require them to have faith in something because they actually saw this event take place. So they didn't have to sacrifice what they experienced or what they knew. And then for others of us, you know, you might be saying, well, gosh, Kurt, the price of readmission or to lean back into faith or to lean into faith for the first time, like it's going to cost me my freedom, right? I mean, because, you know, following Jesus costs you something, which is true. It does cost you something. You know, you it will require you to say no to you at times, all right? Maybe things you want and you now assent to something bigger than just yourself. But think about it. Every worldview requires you to say no to you at times, right? I mean, because every worldview has a certain sense of ought in it, or a certain sense of ought not, or what other people ought to do, or what other people ought not to do. So, I mean, that requires, every worldview requires you to say no to you on some fronts. And then here's another idea that maybe you haven't thought of. All of us, regardless of our worldview, whether it's a faith worldview or it's an atheistic worldview, we all have regrets in our life, right? I mean, every single one of us, we all have things that we wish we could go back and do over. And so this whole idea of saying no to you and, you know, ascending to some higher being, I mean, this isn't anything new. We do this all the time. In fact, here's another thing maybe you've never thought about. In every season of your life, every time you kind of transition into a new season of your life, our frame of reference or our worldview changes. And you might be going, well, no, my mind's always stayed the same. Well, think of it this way. When you were a kid, you hated your parents for taking you to the dentist, right? You hated them for that. And now you drive yourself. Just think about that, all right? So like every season we go through, like our worldview changes. I mean, remember when you like first started dating her, or dating him, and like you couldn't get enough of each other, and you just were like, man, if I could get him to ask me out again, or if I could get her to ask me out one more time. And then it turned into like, if I could just get him to marry me, or if I could get, you know, her to marry me. And so you just, that was like your whole life, and now 10 years later, you're trying to find a way out. Because our worldview changes over time, right? Or that thing you had to have. I mean, that thing you just couldn't live without and you tried to figure out how can I save for it or lease it or finance it or whatever it's going to take. And now that you have it, you're like, I wish I wouldn't have bought it, right? Remember how she made you so mad? I mean, you're like, how could she say that? Or how could he do that? I'm never going to talk to them again. And then you heard the rest of the story, right? And so our worldview, the way we see life, is very, very limited, all right? And it changes at different seasons of our lives. And so now Christians, here's what Christians believe. And you might be a Christian, you're like, I don't even know if I'm going to believe what he says. But here's generally what Christians believe. See, we believe because there's guys like John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these four authorized biographers of Jesus' life. And so John, in one of the most famous verses that probably every American knows, John 3:16, here's what John says. He says that God so loved the world. And what that means is that God had such a big heart for the world that he wanted all of mankind to know who he was. And yet, you know, in the Old Testament part of the Bible, we see God continuing to build humankind's awareness of who he is. Like he's interacting with them, the spiritual being with these earthly beings. He's giving them signs. He's developing this relationship. And this is one of the greatest things God gave mankind was our ability to grow and learn and write things down and pass those on to the next generation. But understand, God was kind of continuing to reveal himself. In John 3:16, the gospel writer John says, God so loved the world that guess what he did? He rushed ahead. He got ahead of the story, and he showed us in person who he is so that we could know what God is like. And this is what we celebrate at Christmas. That God sent someone into our side of the frame, into our frame of reference, into our reality, so we didn't have to wonder anymore, what's God like? We have to wonder about this distant, being that we interact with, but he actually showed up in the flesh, in the form of flesh and love, on our side of the reality, so that we could actually get a picture of who he is. So we're going to look at this document today that we don't always associate with the Christmas story. We find it in the book of Hebrews. And it's this letter, it's a sermon that this writer wrote, to Jewish people in the first century. And we don't know who wrote it. Could have been a man, could have been a woman, which sounds a lot like an old Aerosmith song. But nonetheless, probably a man based on this particular time frame. And so this first century document, we're going to just call this author Hebrews. And here's what this is. It's like a long sermon to these Jewish people who were there when Jesus died. They saw him. They began to believe that this is actually the Messiah we've been waiting on. I mean, which is remarkable in and of itself. And so we had all these people who actually saw Jesus, saw him die, and they're like, we believe he's the Messiah. Even his own brother, all right, even Jesus' own brother, James, like comes late into the game here, and they believed he was the long-awaited Messiah. And yet as time went by, these Jewish Christians found it really difficult in their Jewish communities to continue to hold on to their belief that Jesus really was the Messiah. And so this writer is basically writing this sermon, this letter to say, hey, don't give up. Don't give up. Don't walk away from the faith that you have and these things that you've experienced and that you've seen. So here's the first few verses. I'll read them for you, and then we're going to ask one question at the end this morning. Hebrews writes, therefore, since we have, which is past tense, since we have this great high priest. Now, Jewish people get into this because if you're Jewish, you believe there's got to be a high priest that's between you, the common people, and God. All right? So they're like, now that we have this great high priest that has ascended into heaven. And what that means is these were the disciples that were there, right? When Jesus was with them, they're like, we don't know. He was here talking to us one moment, and he's like, hey, go get him, team. And then all of a sudden, poof, he just like goes up into the sky, and we're just like watching him. There he goes. And he disappeared. And so like, we were there, we saw it. And so they say, since we have this great high priest who has ascended into heaven, this was like not hundreds of years later they're writing this down, it's like a couple years later, Jesus, the Son of God, since we have him, let us hold firmly to the faith that we profess. Now this is the whole ballgame right here in these first couple verses. Let me tell you what he's saying. Let me tell you what the writer Hebrews isn't saying first. What he's not saying is, hey, since everything's going well, since everything's going exactly the way we want it to go, since we've got it all figured out, we've got it all put together, we've got all our answers to the mysteries of the world. You know, he's not saying that at all. What he's saying, he's simply saying, since God sent Jesus to our side of the frame, since God showed up, he rushed ahead so he could show us exactly what he looks like, since there's Jesus, let us hold firmly to the faith that we profess. Later on, a couple chapters later, in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, he goes on, he says this. He says, therefore, since we're surrounded, like we have all these people around us, by this great cloud of witnesses. Now, who's he referring to there? Just the chapter before, in Hebrews 11, he goes through this whole lineage of Old Testament Jewish heroes. And Jewish people would have known all these people. You probably know most of them. It's people like Abel. It's people like Enoch. It's people like, you know, Noah and Abraham and Jacob and Moses. I mean, people you've probably heard of before, right? And so he's like, since we have this whole group of people that have come before us, you know, these Jewish heroes that believed, even though they hadn't seen, they believed, and what they believed was that God was going to do something in the world for the world. And so all these Old Testament heroes, they actually believed God was going to show up on our side of the frame in some way, shape, or form, do something in the world for the world. Jewish people actually believed this. And so this is like before the time of Abraham. And they believe God's going to do something big in the world. In fact, Abraham said, yeah, God showed up one day and told me I'm going to have a family, and that family's going to become a nation. And he's like, he kind of laughed about it. He's like, I can't even have one kid. How can I have a family if my wife and I can't like start a family? But wouldn't you know it, before long, Abraham not only has one son, but he has all kinds of kids, and then those kids reproduce and become a nation. And then that nation, as God said, is going to be a blessing to all people. And so ever since Abraham, Jewish people believe God's going to, in some way, shape, or form, show up in the world and do something for the world. But see, here's the thing. Abraham died before that promise was ever fulfilled. And in the next generation, Abraham's descendants, many of them died before that promise was ever fulfilled. And then the next generation died, the same thing. And so the author of Hebrews here is just saying, hey, hang on to the faith that centers on who Jesus is. Because there were generations before you that had never seen that event where God showed up on this side of the frame. And yet they hung on. They hung on to that faith. And so, I mean, if they can hang on to that when they're waiting for something they haven't seen yet, how much more so for you now that you've seen the fulfillment of what God had promised? So see, they didn't have to check their brain at the door. They didn't have to give up their experience or what they knew to believe in who Jesus was. See, then this is Christmas. This is God coming to our side of the frame. So the writer then says to his first century audience, he goes on, he says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders, anything that gets in the way of, and the sin that so easily trips us up or entangles us or wraps itself around our ankles. Now, for some of us, here's what this verse means right here. When it says the sin, see, if you were raised in a religious framework, all right, if you were raised in a religious context, you know, that the sin that entangles, you would understand and say, well, that's that feeling I get when I sin, when I do something outside of God's best for me, I begin to get this feeling of guilt or shame. And see, again, we can only live in that tension for so long, where I believe certain things, but I don't always behave certain ways, so my belief and my experience are different. And so you either, in those moments, when you would find yourself in a sin that entangled, and guilt began to set in. Now, guilt to me is an indicator, but sometimes we think guilt is like, oh my gosh, I don't like guilt, and somebody or some God is making me feel terrible. And so you were in that moment, and you had to decide, am I going to jump back into that context where I continue to feel guilty for this thing that maybe is outside what God's best is for me, or am I going to get a new frame of reference? Am I going to say, well, maybe that just doesn't exist, or maybe God isn't really here, or maybe God isn't a personal God? And so you changed your point of reference, and your guilt level went down. And suddenly you felt better about yourself. Suddenly you're like, well, I don't feel guilty anymore. And nothing changed. You didn't change anything in your life. You didn't change any behaviors. You just changed your point of reference. And you changed the way you viewed God. You changed the way you view the world. Now, some of you are going, how did you know? Well, because I talked to some of you. I talked to people that have made these decisions and trying to work through faith. I've had countless conversations of people that have said, man, I just got tired of feeling guilty. I mean, I talked to one lady a number of years ago, and she got baptized and, you know, was growing and really leaning into faith. And all of a sudden, we stopped seeing her. And I'm like, you know, I ran into her at like Kroger. And I'm like, you know, hey, how's it going? And she's like, well, I mean, I moved back in with my boyfriend, and I got pulled into some of the things I was a part of before. And she just got caught in that tension between what she believed and what she experienced. And so she kind of changed her point of reference. And usually in those conversations, and I get it. I mean, I totally get it. In those conversations, it's usually something follows. It's kind of like, well, yeah, I just don't feel guilty anymore. There's a freedom. But then usually closely after that is something like, but there's still like something missing. It's like I can't get to a place of peace. The Hebrew writer goes on. He says, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Now, what does that mean? That means that there is a frame of reference in our lives. There's a worldview that allows us to know who God is, and it lets us know how we're to live our lives. That's what he's saying. He says, let's run the race. There's a way to run the race. And then he gives us the way we do it. And this next phrase right here says, fixing our eyes on, and what's the word right there? Jesus. It says, fixing our eyes on Jesus. That's how you run the race. Now, real quick. Your religious upbringing, if you grew up in church, with most of us probably had some religious upbringing, whether you went every week or you went with grandma when she was in town or you went to camp with one of your neighbor friends, whatever that looked like for you, chances are you have a religious framework. You in some way, shape, or form, whether it's tightly or loosely defined, you know, your religious framework focused on something. And chances are, unfortunately, for many of us, it may have focused on something other than Jesus. I mean, it may have been focused on a pastor who was really cool or was really funny and she, you know, was so real or he was so authentic, or it may have focused on like the church and it's like, oh, I got to be in church every single week. And, you know, if I'm not in church, God's going to be mad. And again, I'll run into people, you know, out at like basketball games and things, and people are like, oh man, I ran into somebody at Kroger, at the Starbucks at Kroger yesterday. He said, man, I've been at church in 6 weeks. I'm like, I didn't know, but you're telling on yourself. Like, and it's not that I don't care, but like, I don't walk around with a cosmic clipboard. But so many times we're like, if I'm not in church, God's mad. I mean, being in church, I tell you, I think it's a good thing. Being surrounded and encouraged and, you know, refocusing our time. There's a benefit to that, or we wouldn't do this. But it's not like I'm going to hell if I'm not there. I mean, it's here to be a benefit to us. But maybe you grew up where you were made to feel shameful for not being in church. Or maybe it was the Bible, and it's like you got to believe every word of the infallible word of God. And so the focus was all on the Bible. Or maybe it was an experience you had at camp, or you know, an altar moment where you filled a card out, or you went to a confirmation class, or a new believer class, or whatever, and they're like, hey, you passed, you're in, and yet you didn't even know what you were in for. And so, you know, we have these moments, these experiences, but they don't always line up with what we believe, or, you know, or maybe it was a circumstance. I mean, maybe you grew up in a faith culture where it was all about God coming through. And if you can just tap in and decode, you know, how to get into the power, then everything's going to work out in your life. Well, that's not Christianity at all. That's magic. That's what that's called. All right, tapping into some power. Christianity's different. All right, but maybe for you, it was all about answering a prayer and people told you, and they were loud prayers, by the way. You know, and you're like, man, if you just pray boldly and you believe enough, I mean, the pastor came to your home when your mom was sick and he's like, if you just believe, your mom's going to be healed. But you thought you believed and you prayed loudly and yet you thought, well, the right things will work out, but the right things didn't happen. And so, see, this is why so many people, they grew up in a Christian framework, and we still assent, you know, culturally to Christmas and all these things, but we end up walking away from our faith or what we believe or what we put our trust in the person of Jesus. Because unfortunately, somewhere along the way, maybe our trust wasn't whatever we grew up with, and it wasn't, like, intentional, but the frame of reference, what we were encouraged to put our eyes on, wasn't what the Hebrew writer is talking about right here. He says we're to fix our eyes on Jesus. Why is that? Because, see, Christianity didn't begin with a thought process. It didn't begin as an institution. It didn't begin as a philosophy. It began as a person. It's a person, a real live person. God rushed forward with a person and brought them into the world in the form of flesh and love. Brought them to our side of the reality so we could see clearly and know clearly who God is. And we could put our head on our pillow at night and know what it means to be connected and to be right with the God of the universe. And so here's how he says it. He says, let us run with perseverance and the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. Get this next phrase, the pioneer, which means he's the originator. Jesus, everything began with Jesus. He says he's the originator. He's the founder of faith. It all started with a person. So again, it didn't start with a philosophy. It didn't start as an institute. It began as a person. And then look at this next phrase, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith, meaning he's the one who brings things he starts to successful conclusions. Because he's the author and originator, but he also brings it full circle. And then he gets into the details right here. And see, we sometimes, we read these stories and we romanticize them a bit. It's just like the Christmas story. We romanticize it. We think it's all cool that we have all these little mangers sitting around our house and, you know, these stables. And we're like, oh, I wish I was in the manger. My kids like want a little manger to put their babies in. I'm like, you don't want that. It's dirty. Cows poop and pee next to a manger. I got a dog. We don't need any more of that in our house. Like, mangers are dirty places. We romanticize it though, right? We're like, oh, it was so cool. And we do the same with the end of Jesus' life, right? And so he goes on to talk about the end of Jesus' life right here. And it's fascinating because we romanticize this a bit, you know, and we almost make it like a fairy tale because, see, you and I, we've never seen a crucifixion. You and I, we've never walked by a crucifixion. We've never walked by a body that was being taken off the cross. We've never walked by a crucifixion site, you know, 2 weeks later when the bodies are just laying there at the base, you know, like rotting. And we've never smelled the decay of human flesh because nobody cared enough to take care of that body properly. Like, we've never experienced any of that. But these first century people who are reading this letter called Hebrews, they have seen that. They've actually walked by a crucifixion. And so he goes on, he says, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And then he gives us these next two really powerful words. And remember, he's trying to draw them back in. He's saying, hey, don't lose hold on the thing that you've experienced and that you know. And he says these next two words to them, and in the first century, I think he says them to you, and I know he certainly says them to me. He says, consider him. He says, consider him. He says, will you reconsider him? He says, will you consider his life? Will you consider his teaching? Maybe not all the things you were taught growing up that may or may not have been focused on Jesus. Will you consider him? Will you consider his claims? I mean, again, maybe not everything that's been claimed in the past that may or may not be about Jesus. Maybe they're about a leader or about a church or all these other things. But he says, will you just consider him? Will you consider him, not your experiences and what people have told you if you just pray enough, but will you consider him? Not your circumstances, but will you consider him? Him who endured such opposition from sinners. And here it is, right here's the phrase. So that you. Now he's talking to his first century audience right here, but he's also talking to you and he's also talking to me. So that you will not grow weary and not lose heart. In other words, that you will not lose your belief. See, the reason, perhaps some of us, if we've walked away or we've kind of wandered away from our faith, our believing in Jesus and who he is. I mean, perhaps it was because our focus wasn't really on Jesus. And it's not like that was intentional, but maybe whatever we were connected to or the church we were part of, whatever, the focus was on the church or the Bible, but it wasn't focused on Jesus. And so here's the question I want us to consider this morning. If once upon a time you had a faith, if you grew up in church and you had a faith as a child, or once upon a time, you know, you used to believe, but as you've grown up, as you considered the things that one professor said in college, and you're like, well, I just don't like I have a faith after he told me these things, or, you know, maybe circumstances came into your life and you had somebody close to you that was sick, and you prayed and you prayed and you prayed, and you were told if you just believe, I mean, if you decode what God wants you to say and you say it the right way, then God's going to move it, and you did that. And nothing happened. And you had to try to make sense of it all, and you ended up walking away. Or even if you're thinking about, you know, okay, I'm not sure if I believe in this whole thing. Here's the question. What was that faith fastened to or fixated on? Would you ask yourself that? Because if you walked away from some kind of a religious upbringing or, you know, what was that faith fixated on or fastened to? Because my hunch is it probably wasn't Jesus. Could have been any number of things. Could have been a number of people, a pastor, a leader. Let me just tell you, like, don't fixate on me, all right? Because I'm going to disappoint you. One of my favorite quotes is leadership is disappointing people at a pace that they can handle. I embrace that fully, all right? So don't focus on a leader, all right? Don't focus on a leader. But see, here's the thing. If you walked away or kind of gradually stepped away, just ask yourself, what has my faith been focused and fixated on? And would you be willing this Christmas season, as we're 8 days out, to begin to reinvite Jesus into the center of that picture, back into that worldview? And you know, you might be thinking, well, gosh, you know, Kurt, it may cost me something. It may. I mean, you may have to say no to you some, or you might say, well, do I have to quit doing this or stop doing that? Or I don't know. As one of my friends, Ann Smith, one of my favorite lines of my friend Ann Smith, she spoke here a few times, is just get to know Jesus. Don't worry about all the peripheral. Just focus on Jesus. Get to know Jesus, and he and you will work that out as you go. But this Christmas, if you've walked away, would you be willing to reconsider fixing your eyes on what this Hebrew writer who was there and said, hey, I don't have to check my brain at the door. I know from experience. Let's just hold fast to the thing we've experienced and we know. We're going to do that as we close this morning. We're going to share in this thing that Jesus left us to remember him. It's called the Mass, the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion. There's multiple names for it. It's all one and the same. But it's a moment where Jesus is reclining with his friends, and they're having a meal together. And this was right before he went to the cross, so this is on the other end of his life. And he grabs a piece of bread and a cup off the table. They're just having dinner. It's become known as the Lord's Supper or the Last Supper. They didn't know it was the last. They just thought it was supper, right? It became last later when they realized, oh my gosh, that was the last. And so in the midst of that, he knows what's in front of him as he's heading toward the cross. And so he just takes something very common, I mean, a piece of bread off the table, and he begins to make a spiritual connection with it. He says, you know, every time you eat this bread from this day forward, I want you to remember my body, which is going to be broken for you. And they had no idea what he was talking about. He knew he was going to the cross because he was going to pay the price for the sin of the world. And they probably, like you and I, get distracted, right? We focus on the wrong things. I just picture like Peter there going like, that's awesome, Jesus. Can you pass me the jam? Because I'd like a little jam with that bread if you don't mind. And Jesus is like, just focus on the main thing. It's so easy to get your eyes off of me. And then he picked up the cup. Again, it was just the cup that was on the table. It was a common cup. And began to draw a spiritual connection. He said, every time you drink this cup from this day forward, I want you to remember my blood that was shed for you to establish a new covenant. Like there's something new coming. We're doing a new thing. We're no longer doing the sacrifice system. You know, because everybody knew that in order to forgive sin, you had to sacrifice an animal. It's very bloody and messy, and you had to pick the perfect one and hope that it was the perfect one and that it worked. And he says, we're not doing that anymore. He says, from this day forward, there's always got to be a life source that's given. There's always got to be a sacrificing of a life in some way, shape, or form in order for there to be a forgiveness. Because God is a just God. But he says, from this day forward, my blood, what I'm about to go to do on the cross is going to be the payment for the rest of eternity, if you receive it. And so this morning, we're going to share in this meal, and this is for people who this represents their life. This is for those of us who have began that relationship with Christ, who say, yes, I know Jesus as my Savior, as my rescuer. But it's also for those who want to begin that relationship or want to re-engage in that relationship. Maybe you've been gone for a while, and you've just like, the faith of my childhood just doesn't sustain. Maybe today, this week, as we head into this final week up to Christmas, you're like, you know, I want to reinvite Jesus. I'm not all the peripheral, not all the things I put my hope or fastened my hope to that didn't come through. But would you be willing to consider Jesus? And if so, I'm going to give you a chance to just receive him or receive him again. And then make this your first communion. So let's go ahead and stand, and I want to pray for us. And then we're going to share in the table together. There are four stations. There's two here on the front of the stage. And then there's two in the back corner. So you can go backwards. You can come frontwards. I encourage you to come down the middle aisles and exit to the sides just for flow and to get through. We're going to sing a few songs. And we're just going to kind of focus our attention on Jesus, as this Hebrew writer says. We just consider him. Heavenly Father, we thank you for Christmas. I love Christmas. I love this time of year. I get a little discouraged the day after. I can't wait till next year. There's just something different about this season. And today, God, as we think about belief, there are probably some of us who have stepped away over the years. Maybe some of us even here today, they're like, yeah, I've been, man, God, Jesus, I've been believing, but I'm feeling pulled away. I mean, there's certain things that are causing me to question. God, just help us to get clear on that question. What has our faith, what has our hope been fastened to? And Jesus, we thank you for giving us something that we could tangibly see. Thank you, God, for rushing forward and not, you know, just leaving it up to chance that we might get these glimpses of you and piece together an ongoing understanding, but that you actually rushed forward and came to our side of the story, to our side of reality in the form of flesh and love, so we could see exactly who you are and exactly what it means to know you. And so, Father, if there's any of us in the room this morning or listening online that have been away for a while, it doesn't matter to you how long we've been gone or how far we've been gone. You invite everyone back into the story. And so if we want to re-engage today, God, we just say, yes, Jesus, I want to know you. Would you re-enter the center of my life? I want to receive your forgiveness. I want to receive your grace. Maybe you've never taken a step of faith, and you can utter those same words. It's not the magic or the cadence of the words. It's just the intent and the posture of your heart. I'm saying, yes, Jesus, I want you to be my rescuer. I want to know your grace in my life. I want to know what it means to know you. And so I just ask that you begin that with me right now, through your blood, through your grace, through what you did on the cross. Things can be made right between me and you. And know that all of us that are receiving that right now, that there's a spiritual transformation taking place right now. It doesn't work everything in life out, but there's a spiritual transformation taking place in you. And Jesus, I just pray that for anyone who is receiving you, God, that you would receive them and that you would fill them with your spirit, the same spirit that raised your son, Jesus, from the grave, that would reside in every single one of us who are receiving you or willing to continue to receive you. And that we would know what to do next. And you would guide us. And it doesn't mean, well, I always will do the right thing, but that you will be a guiding presence, a leader in our lives. So God, we thank you for that still, quiet, silent night when you broke into our side of the frame, when you rushed forward so that we could see you and we could know what it means to know you. And we could lay our heads on our pillows at night knowing that things are right between you and us. So thank you. And thank you for this meal that we're about to share to remind us that it's all about you. For it's in your name, according to your character, we pray. Amen. So as we sing, we invite you to share in the tables in the front or the back. If this doesn't represent your life, I just encourage you to observe, to watch. If you just received him, make this your first communion. Let's sing together.